coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio. Located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
And welcome, folks, to this edition of the Hagman Report. I'm going to tell you something. I've got a very special report, folks. You're going to want to. You are going to want to bookmark this, share this episode, really pay attention to what is going to be said here, because everything you're seeing today, everything that you're seeing play out in the world of politics, in the world of our American culture, and as Andrew Breitbart had famously said, politics, of course, is downstream from culture, and I really believe that. I have the tremendous opportunity to be able to speak with Jack Cashel, and who I believe is one of the most gifted, talented authors, investigative writers on the planet. And, you know, he has written books about TWA 800, really just shattering the narratives of the deep state, whatever you want to call that permanent bureaucracy. And his latest book, which I just consumed, is Ashley. Now, that's the cover, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th. But it's much more than that. It really is much more than that. There are so many pieces of information. Look, I spent my life, adult life, as an investigator. And to me, this would be like a courtroom exhibit. And I say that about some books, not all, but some. But this is one of the books that I think should be in the hands of everyone who cares about the events of today and wants to know the real story, not just about the women, although the women of January 6th play a very key role in everything. But really what happened on January 6th as the left, or as Jack refers to them, and accurately so, the Jacobins, he used a phrase in there that just is stuck in my mind, Jacobin justice. Man, I'm going to tell you, that was like a home run to me. But I'm going to start this out because Jack Cashel is with me. Folks, if you do nothing else this weekend, I really highly recommend you order this book and read this book. Go to Amazon, Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th. The link will be at Hagman PI under the title. Just click on the title, open it up, and of course the link directly there will be present. But I just want to, as you keep that up so people don't have to see me reading here, I just want to read a quote at the last chapter of his book. It's a short quote. It's by Naomi Wolf, who, I know that she was a rabid liberal at one point, but when she really understood things and she really got an awakening, she changed her tune. And Jack quotes her as follows. The gatekeepers who lie to the public about the most consequential events of our time and who thus damage our nation, distort our history, and deprive half of our citizenry of their right to speak, champion and choose, without being tarred as would-be violent traitors, deserve our disgust. They deserve our disgust. And he adds, this one-time liberal icon wasn't through. I am sorry I believed so much nonsense, she concluded. Though it's no doubt too little too late, conservatives, Republicans, MAGA, I am so sorry. Think about that. This awakening. As more people awaken to the current events, I'm telling you right now, there is an awakening that's happening. And Jack Cashel is, I believe, at the tip of the spear of this awakening. In my view, he should be on every show, every conservative podcast, broadcast, lunacast, whatever, because of this book. So he's with me right now. He's agreed to share some extended time with me, and I am so appreciative. I'm glad to call him my friend and a friend of the program, and more importantly, just a man of truth and honor. So, Jack, thank you so much for coming back and continuing our conversation from, I guess, last week it was, about the things about January 6th. How are you, sir?
Yeah, okay. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for the work you do. You know, the Naomi Wolf's a good, I think you're right. She's an indicator of the trend. Yeah. And right now it is at the, it's at the trickle-down level. But you're seeing major kind of left and left-center intellectual forces or commentariat, not necessarily intellectual, like Russell Brand, for instance, or Joe Rogan, Elon Musk. But then you see people like Jordan Peterson and Doug Murray and all these other people who are not only, they're recognizing now that the force we're facing isn't just a political enemy. It's a sort of a diabolical, deeper, you know, almost demonic enemy. And thus, there's not only a political awakening going on, but a spiritual awakening. And a lot of people are embracing their, you know, in Naomi Wolf's case, she's Jewish. She's going deeper into her Jewish roots. But a lot of people are finding Christ, you know, which is people you never expect, right? And
that's right.
I think they need that. They need that base for the fight that's ahead against the enemy that we face.
You know, the enemy is, to me, is a hydra. I mean, it's like an octopus, many tentacles out there. But the head of the hydra, certainly, to me, is this evil that really is propelling all of this, whatever isms exist out there. The thing about the book, when I received the book and I first started reading it, you had made a comparison, throughout the book there is the theme of this Jacobin, what would you call it? The taking it back to the...
Yeah, you know, in fact, your phrase Hydra had it exactly right. The opposition that we're facing is... has multiple faces, multiple fronts. And I was looking for a phrase that encompassed them all. And what I came up with was a reference to the group that emerged in revolutionary France in the late 18th century. And it was their real name was like the Constitutional Club or something or another, but they met in a convent. It was known as the Jacobins, and that became their trademark. Basically, it was the more revolutionary members of the National Assembly, and they grew to add... elite members of the, bourgeoisie. So what they did, these were like, so the intellectual political elite of France, their power came from mobilizing the mob to get what they wanted, right? And so I talk about the America's Jacobin Club, and to this club belongs right now every Democrat, some Republicans, virtually everyone in the intelligence community now, many in the military, the Jacobin clubs of Hollywood and Silicon Valley control their destiny. The Jacobins have infected the educational, kind of own the educational complex. Higher ed they've owned for a half century, not to mention increasingly into the medical industry. So rather than talk about if you can't find a word just to describe those power sources, I condense them into the phrase Jacobins, and I use that word a lot, rather than using the Democratic media political complex or whatever. I just boil it down into one word.
And it's being weaved, or you weave it throughout the book. And, you know, I really kind of want to get into, to the extent you wish to, the various the people involved, and you know, some of the very same players at the higher level of what's taking place today, whether it's with Donald Trump and the judiciary, whether it's the former J6 committee, unselect committee, the mm-hmm. politicians. But this encapsulates essentially the entirety of January 6th, I believe, and it really shows the framework of what we're into today. So, but you go through this, folks, it's a great read, and there's so many nuggets in here that you can use in conversation with your fellow antagonist, okay? Somebody who maybe doesn't agree with you, but there's information in here that, frankly, I did not know. And I thought I knew a lot, but I didn't. I mean, the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner of D.C., I didn't know it. I mean, I knew, but I didn't know the role that was played there. So, but in talking about this book, where do you want to start? Because, man, I could just pick a page and point. We could talk for hours on whatever, but.
What I could do, Doug, is tell you just how I got into it, because that's important here.
Yeah,
I wanted to tell this. I woke up one morning, and I talk about this in the foreword. Literally, I just woke up in the morning, and the word Ashley was in my brain. I said, Ashley, A-S-H-L-I. Why has no one written about this, you know? So I emailed Julie Kelly, who's really the matriarch of this whole story. And I said, Julie, has anyone written a book or writing a book about Ashley Babbitt? No. She said, that's a good idea, though. Good project. Go ahead. So, and then almost providentially, my agent called that day and he wanted to run some ideas by me. And they were both, they were not winners. You wouldn't want to have me on your show to talk about them. Soporific. And he said, do you have any ideas? I said, yeah, I do. I just woke up this morning with the word Ashley on my brain, you know? And then he ran it by the publisher, this is Post Hill, Anthony Zuccardi. And Zuccardi loved it. He said, within 2 days, I had a contract. This almost never happens. And we needed that kind of time because it was to get the book out in, for the summer. So it has some impact on the outcome of future elections. We had to get that done. And but I wanted to tell the story of what motivated Ashley Babbitt to go to Washington. And there's a big story there. But then I realized that given her death on January 6th, that there just wasn't enough information. So I brought in the scope to find out what other women like her, what motivated them. And I ended up profiling 10 women, two of whom died that day. One is Ashley, of course, and her death is pretty well known among certain circles. Even among on the right, however, the death of Roseanne Boyland is almost unknown. And that's a big part of the story because her death was, in many ways, even more shocking than Ashley Babbitt's. And then 8 other women who survived that day, all of whom, and I was really just thrilled at this, and to give some credit to our mutual friend, Susan Daniels, a private investigator,
great
who helped lady. Me find women and make the first contact. 6 of whom have already been to prison and 2 of whom await sentencing. And among the 8, the worst crime any of them committed was breaking a window. And to tie it to today's events, you know, where why we sit here, you know, waiting the outcome of the trial in New York or the consequences of that verdict, we see that what is happening to Donald Trump is just a further manifestation of what Naomi Wolf was talking about that you mentioned, and that is the Jacobin attempt to control all information, all power, not in just in the United States, but throughout the world. And they're not necessarily working. There's not like Jacobin HQ where they all get together and make their plans. They're all just moving in the same direction. They know what there must be like some sort of DNA implanted in their general gene pool that pushes them forward to the same end goal. And that end goal is to throw off, the traditional Christian, Judeo-Christian order that is just on which America is founded, to destroy the family, destroy the you know, the culture, destroy the schools, destroy the institutions, the churches that have made America such a unique and gifted place. And they don't need directives. They don't need a George Soros. They all have a playbook, roughly the same. And when they find opportunities to exercise that playbook, they do it, sometimes to their own detriment, like as they've been finding with this whole lawfare thing. They made Donald Trump the candidate. And now they're making Trump, barring the unforeseen, a very formidable candidate every time they do something. So we like to think of them as some monolithic force that is smarter than us. It's not monolithic and it's not smart, but they are determined and they are diabolical. And it was time, I think, to tell the story of what they've been doing, not just on January 6th and beyond, but really in the 6 years leading up to January 6th.
And you address that in this book, again, a fabulous book. I mean, everything from the thought police that played a role in the response of the women and the men to appear in D.C. on January 6th, and the role of the police. I was astounded, by the way, at both accounts of the two deaths of the women, Ashley Babbitt and of course Roseanne Boylan. Did you know? I mean, when you went into this, did you know not necessarily the whole story, but did you have an inkling that there was something off on both? Because obviously, the information you provide in this book, and I'm not going to give away the details of what Jack found unless he wants to. But
you know, what we might want to talk about, Doug, is, you know, because I know last time I talked a lot about Ashley and her death, and that's pretty well established, pretty well known, because it was captured on video and it was hard for them to deny. And as I mentioned, I think last time, it set in motion the whole the murder of Brian Sicknick. I mean, in other words, they had to have him be murdered, even though he was not the Capitol police officer. Then not only murdered, but martyred with a ceremony in the rotunda of the Capitol. The last such ceremony was for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and then a burial at Arlington. Let's talk for now about Roseanne Boylan's death.
Oh, great.
This is a fascinating story.
Yes.
And no one knows about it. You know, even on the right, people don't even know the name. They don't know who she is. They don't know that a second woman was killed there that day. In fact, four people died that day, four protesters, three of whom arguably were killed as a result of police actions. And one, Kevin Reason, the other one. But Roseanne's death speaks to the complexity of the Jacobin Club and the way they work independently, but as though they had a gene planted in their head to make this happen, or some sort of like a Manchurian candidate thing that, you know, you get brainwashed and you know what you're going to do. But just a little background on Roseanne, because she is an outlier in many ways. Most of the other women, and this is the beauty of America, is that these 10 women, and I wrote about women because I wanted to reflect on what Ashley was thinking and doing. And the men are just as heroic and just as worthy of our attention, but I'm focusing here on the women. How is it that they knew what it took Naomi Wolf, someone who's really, really smart, years to find out? You know,
that's a great question.
And half of America still hasn't found out.
Yeah.
How were they able to intuit what was going on? None of them. Simone Gold was an exception, too. She was a lawyer and a doctor. But the other eight were nurses, school teachers, occupational therapists, military people. How is it they knew? And Roseanne Boylan was late to the game.
Yes.
And actually, her being late to the game opened the doors on this story that was unwittingly revealed by MSNBC, of all people. I got to give them some credit here. But so Roseanne Boylan is living a kind of a troubled life. She is not your model young Republican. She's been on probation for the last, she's 34 years old on January 6th. She's been on probation for the last 10 years for a drug bust. And nor does she come from your average drug family. She has two loving sisters, parents who care for her. You know, you come from an intact family. And they play a major role in the revelation of her death. But in the last 6 months, the year of her life, she had become what her sisters called radicalized.
And that term, as you describe in the book, radicalized in the sense of watching Fox News. I mean,
yeah, right. Wanting to vote.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
And Ashley Babbitt's mother, Mickey Whitthoff, uses the phrase activated, not radicalized, to describe her daughter. But she was in a drug rehabilitation. She had been cleared from, you know, she'd gone, you know, basically cleaned up her life. She was still meeting with a lot of people, though, through these drug, you know, what do you call it, Alcoholics Anonymous and stuff. But that was her world. She's met some people who changed her and helped influence, opened her eyes. And you see later in her letters and her diary notes that she was a really clear-thinking person. But her sisters thought that she had been, like, mentally kidnapped by a QAnon cult, and she'd lost all sense of what she was doing. And that's what drove her to go to Washington. But when, like I say, when you read her notes and tweets and entries, you see that she was really pretty cognizant. Her father was sympathetic. I got the sense that, you know, they watched Fox News together. They were fishing buddies. She was still living at home. And COVID was, you know, causing her additional problems. In addition to her his drug use, she was pretty overweight. And part of that was due to the fact that she had had cervical cancer sometime. She couldn't have children, despite the fact that she loved her nieces. And so she was going through a transitional period in her life, and the lockdown didn't help anything, living at home. But she found a new source of information and belonging. And she and her father bonded over. They'd watch Fox News together. Her father even took her to see Donald Trump Jr. speak at a gun club event in Georgia. She's from Kennesaw. And so she goes up to Washington on January 6th, the night before. Actually, everyone drove because they were all, to a person, dissenters from the COVID regime and would not subject themselves to the airlines, you know, absurd criteria for taking a flight. And so she drives up the night before with this, with her friend, Justin. And Justin's a good guy. He's texting her father back on the way. And he says, you know, listen, if you can lose touch with Roseanne, you can always talk to me, blah, blah, blah. His name is Justin Winchell. And they arrive. She and her father are exchanging texts throughout the day. Her father is a good father. I mean, he really cares for her, and he's encouraging her to be careful. And meantime, he's giving her some overview of what he's seeing on TV. And then when they announce a curfew at 6 o'clock, he says, "Watch that curfew. You guys got to get out of there. Go sightseeing or something." You know. In the meantime. You know, Roseanne has gone to watch Trump, which means she gets to the Capitol an hour after the action's begun, because his speech ends at 1:15. The first Capitol breach is at 12:53. And this is a major point in the book, is that, and I don't know why even the people on our side overlooked this. If he incited a riot, how is it that the people who were listening to him speak didn't get there until an hour after the riot started? I mean, literally. And curiously, Doug, he started an hour late. And I've been asking people, why did he start an hour late? Even the people on the inside don't know that. But it proved to be a saving grace in the whole day. So Roseanne gets there, and she ends up in the front of on the west side, in front of this tunnel entrance. Now she's there. This is after 4 o'clock. There have been people wandering around the Capitol for 2 hours. there are multiple open doors. The people inside the building, there was some vandalism breaking, getting into the Capitol. Some doors and windows were broken. But most people in the Capitol just walked through an open door. Some of them were open from the inside. And they typically would walk around 10, 15 minutes, take videos. Then they get lost. They didn't know how to get out. They try to find their way out. And then they'd walk out, and it was an uneventful day. I mean, they get arrested for it, but there was, for them, no big deal. Inside the Capitol, I looked at, you know, hours of video. I haven't seen any vandalism inside the building, let alone any arson, let alone any violence against the police officers, other than a little jostling and pushing. But Roseanne is caught in the scrum outside this West Terrace tunnel entrance that the police are defending it like it was the friggin' Alamo. Meanwhile, upstairs, everyone's wandering around like the other police that are acting like tour guides. It just, if you're looking for a plan among the police response, it's hard to find it. It's a part where conspiracy ends and incompetence begins. There's some fine line there, and if you're not going to find it easily. But she gets caught in the scrum in front of the Capitol, this entrance, the tunnel entrance. And, you know, she's not big. She's obviously not powerful. When you get caught up in one of these things, it's like at a soccer match in Europe. You lose absolute control over your destiny.
It's kind of like driving in New York City. You can, I've often said this, I can put my car in neutral and be pushed by other vehicles. I mean, but I get that. And you really paint that picture. And by the way, I'm familiar with that area of the Capitol, having from prior visits, obviously. And it's kind of, you're caught. I mean, you don't have much room to maneuver anywhere within that entrance, the entranceway, and then immediately outside of that. So go ahead.
And then you're right. The tunnel entrance is narrow. And the tunnel's, you know, not very long. Then it leads to some, sealed glass doors behind which at this time were the Metropolitan Police, the D.C. Police, not the Capitol Police. And at some point, Roseanne gets separated from the guy she's with, Justin. And it's not by any design. She ends up actually right next to a black protester named Philip Anderson, who had his teeth knocked out by Antifa a few months earlier at another protest on the West Coast. And they end up side by side as they're getting pushed into this, you know, by the crowd behind them. There may be provocateurs in that crowd. You don't know. There may be undercover police. You don't know. They may just be, you know, jerks from the Trump side. That's possible, too, obviously. But then the Capitol Police decide to make a countercharge. And they start off by spraying everyone with some chemical irritant, which sucks the air out of the tunnel entrance. And people are fainting even before they start getting pushed. And then the Capitol Police make a concerted surge and push this whole crowd down these sort of temporary steps that have been put up for the inauguration, just like a waterfall of people falling backwards.
Right.
So she's not being trampled by people walking on her. She's being trampled by people being pushed upon her. And she finds herself at the bottom of the pile, and she reached out and grabs Philip Anderson's hand. And, you know, he's dying. He knows he's at his last breath. He's at the bottom of the pile with Roseanne. And he starts crying out, help, you know, please, you know. And as is Roseanne, Justin Winchell, Roseanne's friend, is off the side saying, help us, please, you know. Several people approach the police, stop this, you're killing people, right? And so finally they peel off the pile, and Roseanne is left there for a moment at the bottom, right at the tunnel entrance. And this is where the most horrifying moment of the whole day happens, and it's caught on video. There's no mystery here. A small female, black officer, Metropolitan Police, picks up a branch that had been thrown up there by someone, and she starts beating Roseanne over the head.
Let's make her famous. This would be Officer Lila Morris.
Right? Lila Morris, right. Okay. There's no denying who she is. And captured on video, it even came up in one of the the trials for someone else involved. And he beats her over the head. She beats Roseanne over the head with this branch about three times, with a bit like taking a full like sledgehammer swing.
And she hit her so hard, she broke the friggin' branch.
The branch, and it flies out of her hands. And at that time, she may still be alive, right?
Right.
So then the protesters, the fellow protesters, pull her aside and try CPR on her. One of them, Jake Lang, has been in prison for the last 1,000 days without so much as a trial. And these are the ones Philip Anderson said, if it wasn't for Lang and the other guy, I think it was Maccabee, he'd be dead, because they were the ones who unpiled the pile and pulled him out. So then when they cannot revive her, they bring her back to the tunnel entrance and ask the police to say, you got to, you know, maybe you have some devices here that could defibrillate her or whatever. And so one cop just grabs her by one leg,
yep,
and just starts pulling her back into the tunnel, right? So the protesters see this and they pick her up, you know, rather than just watching her be dragged. And then, you know, then the calls start coming. Winchell calls back, Justin, her friend, calls back to her, texts to Brett's father, Roseanne's father, Brett Boylan, and says, you know, something bad happened. Roseanne's been hurt. I've lost her. They took her into the tunnel. I don't know where she is. So then the mom and dad, and like, she has great parents. I mean, they really love their daughter. The mom starts calling every hospital, police station in D.C., trying to find out, you know, what happened. And then about midnight, the mom gets a call from the police, Metropolitan Police, and they said, we have your daughter. And the mom has this momentary sense of relief, thinking they have arrested her. And then the cop says, does she have a tattoo?
Yeah.
And then the mom knows that she's dead.
Yeah.
And she died. And I had to give a little credit as to how we know all of this. And this is where the story gets a little strange, but it's worth noting that sometimes, even accidentally, MSNBC does some good reporting. And they regretted it, but they did it. The sister, the older sister of Roseanne, was named Lana, and she was married to a guy named, I believe it was Justin Cave. And so on the day after Roseanne's death, once her name becomes public, the Boylan family becomes the source of leftist outrage and contempt. You know, really harsh kind of, you know, like sending roses for your, put this on the casket of your dead redneck daughter, you know,
yeah,
things like that.
When I read that, I had to read that like two or three times, because I'll quote from the book. Here's some roses for your dead redneck daughter's casket.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is, it gets worse though, but go ahead.
Yeah. And that's from our friends on the left who are loving and caring. And then Cave, the brother-in-law, you know, reads the you know, he's had some TV experience, so he reads the standard script that was approved by the family. And then he goes off script, and the chapter is called Off Script. And he says, he then blames it all on Trump, for your best supporters, you killed them. Yeah, we need the 25th Amendment, take him out of office, just out of, you know, impromptu. And then Cave, the brother-in-law, contacts MSNBC because he went to high school with Ayman Mohyeddin, who is an anchor at MSNBC, an Egyptian-born guy. And then he says, how would you like an insight on how QAnon, you know, killed my sister-in-law, right? And, of course, MSNBC was salivating over that possibility. So they start an investigation. And they do a five-part podcast. And this is where their story gets interesting. They're the one who provide all the family background and details, because the Boylan family is the only family that I could not make contact with. So I relied on MSNBC's information. And it was vast. It was deep. It was good. But what they find out then is that Mohyeddin, hoping to you know, his plot line, his narrative was to be QAnon, you know, crazy QAnon mind cult, you know, captures a former drug addict. No, that's not the story that presents itself. The real story is that he's going to learn. He's going to be pulled down the rabbit hole of Jacobin justice in Washington, D.C., and learn there is no justice. And so will the family. So will her sisters and her brother-in-law will learn that nothing is simple when people have an agenda, and that agenda is to deny even their relatives the truth of what happened that day.
It's unforgivable, in my view, when you look at this case, the what you call the Jacobin justice, how extensive this is, this rot is. And I'll just say this with respect to Roseanne, what they did to the family, what they did to the memory of Roseanne, what they did to, and what they're doing today to President Trump and to others, to the J6 prisoners or hostages, whatever you want to call them. I mean, it's far-reaching, and the people in key positions as well, and I may be getting ahead of myself here, within the medical examiner's office and such, that overlaps like a Venn diagram with the George Floyd case, and it's all exposed here, folks, in this book that you've got to get. I'm telling you, if you don't get it, I'm not sure we can talk, because...
I have to give credit to the people who did a lot of the spade work for me beforehand, especially Julie Kelly and Nick Searcy, Laura Logan, Jim Hoff, Kara Kashinova, the people at Epoch Times, Joe Daneman. I mean, I couldn't have even proceeded without their groundwork. But I would say my own unique contribution to the understanding what happened on January 6th was what I knew about the medical examiner's office from my investigation of the Derek Chauvin trial.
You know, and that blew my mind when I saw the overlap there. And again, I had to read the, maybe I'm slow on the update, I had to read that that chapter and that section a couple of times to really get the that holy crap moment of like, wait a second. None of this is true, and it's a diabolical thing. What they back to Roseanne, what they attempted to do, and what they essentially did in conjunction, along with the J6 Unselect Committee. I mean, all of this is, and what they're doing today. So, I didn't mean, but Roseanne. But by the way, Roseanne, I feel like I kind of got to know her through your writing, and compliments again to MSNBC. Can't believe I'm saying that, but so she was, just so people know, she was prescribed Adderall, and she took it as prescribed, but that does come into play later, I suppose. But there was no record of like any drug abuse or anything like that concurrent with January 6th. Go ahead, sir.
No, and I'll at some point, Doug, I'll get back to the involvement of where the Chauvin trial comes in.
Okay.
But let's just say for the moment that the medical examiner of the D.C. office, D.C. medical examiner, was a black activist named Roger Mitchell on January 6th. He was the head of the medical. He was the medical examiner. And he was also a player. He was the deputy mayor of Washington, D.C., knew everyone, had a lot of influence, wasn't afraid to use it, and had a gift for ruining lives, including Derek Chauvin's.
And just to be clear, I just want to say this. Folks, remember this name. Make him famous. Dr. Roger Mitchell. Mitchell was threatening to ruin many people's lives, including Andrew Baker, for reasons related to George Floyd. But go ahead, sir.
But back to and on January 6th, he's the head of the medical examiner's office in D.C. And it would play a role in both Roseanne's case and in Brian Sicknick's case. There was each case equally diabolical. So, right, there's not much attention paid to Roseanne's death by the media afterwards. Ashley Babbitt gets attention because she was so obvious. And the guy who shot her, who was a black activist, BLM would-be, wannabe, sold the video to CNN. But Roseanne died anonymously. A few days later, the New York Times reports that she'd been trampled to death, right? And they repeat that, you know, a couple of weeks later, just offhandedly, she was trampled to death. And so the Boylan family now wants to get the truth. They want, you know, they're petitioning the medical examiner's office to tell us, how did Roseanne die, right? Now, in the case of George Floyd, it was within a week, his autopsy report was made public. With Roseanne Boylan, it would be 90 days, which was the limit.
That's the statutory limit. Yeah.
Right. So for 90 days, they sat on her autopsy report. And so Roseanne Boylan was totally forgotten. She was just one of those extraneous deaths on, you know, like the two fellows that died, Benjamin Phillips and Kevin Greeson, just, you know, died in the crowd because of the crowd. Blamed on the crowd and whatever. And then they released the autopsy report and they decide that she died of amphetamine overdose, right? And the family shocked. They said she didn't take drugs. There's no fentanyl, there's no meth, you know, like unlike George Floyd. And what happened to all the visual evidence, all the reports, the initial reports, all the eyewitnesses to her death? None of them were ever talked to. Her death was never investigated by the DOJ at all. No crime scene, no one talked to, no one, you know, the police officers never even questioned, right? And the family was heartbroken because Roseanne had spent years getting clean. And now she's being publicly smeared as a drug addict, right? And that was beautiful because then her death tainted the rest of the protesters. Oh, one of those Trump people who died is just a drug overdose. My gosh, you know, what rabble, you know? And that began the quest by the Boylans to get at the truth. And every time they turned, every place they turned, and MSNBC turned too, they got stonewalled. They got stonewalled by the police. They got stonewalled by the medical examiner's office. No one wanted to talk to them. No, yeah, it was an amphetamine overdose. That's it. And all she was taking was Adderall. She'd been taking it for 10 years. And it was an awakening for the Boylan family. The guy, Ayman Mohyeldin from MSNBC, did not want to be awakened, but he was beginning to see. And he said, you know, the trampling, the riots, the protests, the smothering, all this, what happened to this? Why is this not? You do autopsy reports, you have to consider the context of how someone died. And that much was known and established. And in the medical report, the autopsy report just ignored it all altogether. And so what the Boylan family did with MSNBC's help was to find an alternative, pathologist to review the data. And the one they found, one of them just didn't want to say anything, but the other one they found said, this is ridiculous. We know the surrounding circumstances of her death. We have witnesses to that. Because Mohyeldin had been talking to some of the witnesses. He talked to Philip Anderson, and we talked to Winchell. These people were saying, now she was smothered under this mob after she was being gassed, you know, with this, I think they're using OC gas in the tunnel. And this is how she died. Then she got beaten after she got pulled from the pile. None of that's in the autopsy report. And that's when the Boylan family began to distrust MSNBC's motives. Because what Mohyeldin did then was he found a few of Roseanne's Trump-hating friends and tried to get them to say that Roseanne may have been back on drugs. And there may have been, the autopsy report may have been legitimate. And that's when the sisters, Roseanne's sisters, Big Libs, said no, they didn't trust him anymore. He had to acknowledge it. And then they started talking to Gateway Pundit, right? Yeah. Which drove Mohyeldin nuts because Gateway Pundit wanted to get at the truth. you know, the Gateway Pundit is a conservative outlet. It's done a lot of good work on this on January 6th. And MSNBC didn't do any good work. They wanted, that's not the narrative they wanted. They wanted the QAnon narrative, and they weren't getting that. In fact, when you get into Roseanne's diaries and her notes, you see that she was moved. She understood what was going on January 6th. She was hoping that the enough states would reject the certification, you know, and she explained why. She was totally engaged. She was not a QAnon fanatic. You know, I mean, this is crazy. Everyone, by the way, all the women who were, as soon as they're arrested, they would be branded a QAnon fanatic by the headlines. And even in their small towns, no one knew what QAnon was, but it sounded, you know, diabolical and suspicious, and the media were happy to run with that. So, yeah, the Boylan family learned a lot, but they never got an answer. And if they waited for the, you know, the House subcommittee report to come out, you know, it was like 800 pages long. There's no mention of Roseanne, not even in the footnotes.
Yeah, I read that, and how could that possibly be in such an exhaustive investigation, as we've been told? But go ahead.
And then in one of the hearings, I think it was Representative Gohmert of Texas asked Merrick Garland. He said, how did Roseanne Boylan die? You know, and then I think he said, is it true that a police officer beat her over the head with a stick? And he said, well, we're investigating that now. Yeah, we're looking into that. And they didn't. There was no DOJ investigation into her death. None of the eyewitnesses was ever talked to. And Lila Morris, you know, she went to the Super Bowl a month later, got honored, right?
Yes.
And still, as far as I know, still on the MPD. Just as a side note to all of that, for the first time, it was in early 2024, she was called in as a witness in a trial, one of the J6ers, and who had been accused of hitting her. And she testified honestly, no, that he didn't hit her. And then the defense attorney says, what do you usually use a stick or baton for? And how are they used? Oh, she said, oh, we're supposed to hold them in both hands. One end on, you know, one hand on either end, and push people back. That's what they're designed. He said, are they designed to be hit people over the head with? No. And then he said, why did you hit that Roseanne Boylan over the head? And then he withdrew the question, not wanting to irritate the judge. He knew what he wanted to establish. And she had to acknowledge that she was the one who did it. There's no mystery there. And yet she remains, you know, an officer in good standing, you know, beating up a dead woman or a dying woman with a stick. Okay, you know. And meanwhile, Derek Chauvin spends 22 years in prison.
You know, so what I read in your book, and again, folks, the book, please do yourselves a favor and order the book today. I've never been so impressed by a work by Jack always delivers, but man, this is just so prescient to today's events as well. When you look at the initial and official, what would it be? The medical examiner's report of Roseanne in this case, it's really the mirror image of George Floyd's. You know, wow. I mean, the diabolical, as you, in your word, diabolical part of this is so overt in your face. And to see Roseanne, by the way, in death, treated this way, forgotten, even besmirched in the media, it breaks my heart because it shouldn't be. But go ahead, sir. Continue.
You know, I think one thing I'm hoping is that I haven't talked to the Boylan family. I don't know. They're probably not eager to get back into this story. Probably rather it just go away. But I think their daughter's memory needs to be resurrected.
Yes.
When last left by the media, and the New York Times reports are almost comical. So they had been reporting a couple times that she had been caught in a crowd, trampled, etc. And then at the time the medical examiner's report comes out, they write, Although initially thought to have been suffocated in the crowd, we now learn that she died of overdose, you know. Not methamphetamine, by the way, just amphetamine crisis or something. And you know, it goes back to that Orwellian, the quote from 1984, the final command of the party was to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. And they did it all the way through, let alone the House subcommittee, which, you know, was an epic exercise in the party command. Forget the evidence, reject the evidence.
Man, it's absolutely incredible. As I look upon the book right now in this issue. By the way, you write of note two, the relevant body cam footage in Roseanne's death was withheld, strategically withheld, just as it was for Floyd's.
Yeah, that's strategic reasons. And even the father's Freedom of Information Act request, right, was denied. He wanted to see Lila Morris's body cam footage, denied.
Yeah.
It came out in another trial, so we've seen it since, but you know, wasn't at the time, it was suppressed. And that's where we get into the curious parallels here with the Chauvin trial.
Okay.
And it's not a stretch to understand the connection. You know, I'd done a lot of work on reporting on Chauvin's trial, George Floyd's death, et cetera. I've just said to some people, this was my daughter's a little concerned about the kind of work I do. And I told my one daughter, who's a supporter, I said, you know, I'm working on a new book. And she goes, it's not about Derek Chauvin, is it? No, you can relax. I said it was about Ashley Bashel. Okay. It's because she knows how toxic that subject is in America's newsrooms. You know, it's like no one wants to. It is, you might as well, you know, wear a white hood to work if you're going to talk about Derek Chauvin in any kind of positive way. But here's the connection. Roger Mitchell, Dr. Roger Mitchell, medical examiner, district attorney, I'm sorry, the District of Columbia, on January 6th, and he resigns about a month later. He's phasing into another job, but he obviously has control over that office and over other medical examiner's offices throughout the country. He's a very engaged black activist. We know what happened next due to the fact that he bragged about it to the state prosecutors, and they made a memorandum about it that showed up in the trial, or in one of the preliminary hearings for one of Chauvin's colleagues, Tuo Tao, a Cambodian. And what happened is that Mitchell goes to the prosecutors, has an interview with them, and I think this is November 2021, and he tells them what he did in regard to the Floyd autopsy. Now, the Floyd was killed on, Floyd died, let me rephrase that, on May 25th, 2020, and that set off the summer of riots. The next day, Andrew Baker, the medical examiner for Hennepin County, Minnesota, gets the commission to do the autopsy. At the end of that day, May 26th, he reports back to the county prosecutors, you're not going to like what I'm going to tell you because it goes against the narrative. And he's really uneasy about it. And he confesses that. And this comes out later in another trial. He goes, he did not die of strangulation or asphyxiation. You know, he had very severe heart disease. He also, his system was loaded with drugs. And it's likely he just died of natural causes, right? And he says, no one's going to like this. And he's concerned about what to do with that information. Well, somehow that word gets to Roger Mitchell back in Washington. Mitchell now is no longer, you know, this is, I'm sorry, May 2020. He is the medical examiner of Washington, D.C. at that point. And he contacts Baker back in Minneapolis and says, I saw the preliminary report. That cannot stand. You don't know what's going to happen to you if you let that stand. You know, your reputation's going to be ruined and possibly worse. And then, by the way, this is what Mitchell is telling the prosecutors. He's confessing this. He's bragging about what he did. And then he said, I thought about it over the weekend. And then I called him back and I said, listen, I'm going to do an op-ed in the Washington Post and I'm going to make your life hell unless you amend that autopsy report. And Baker amended it to include neck compression. And that was all they needed to nail Chauvin and the others for murder.
Despite the lack of evidence of any injuries to his neck, I mean, this is kind of like, you know, boy, that's a nice restaurant you have there. It'd be a shame if it burned down.
That's right.
You know, the Jacobin justice system is in play. Hold that thought, Jack. I want to acknowledge the people who support this broadcast. Thank you so much, as well as our sponsors as well. And one of the sponsors, which I'll tell you what, works for me and works for many people, is don'twastepower.com. Folks, if you look at today's video, click on the link directly below, which is don'twastepower.com. You can get up to 66% off right now by clicking that link and taking advantage of this offer, because we know right now that groceries, rent, gas, they're not the only bills to be rising to unaffordable levels. Energy bills are reaching record highs too. In fact, yesterday or the day before I don't know, I did have a chart and looked at the cost of energy. It's up 40% over the last 3.5 years. You know, over 20 million households are behind on their power bills. Some power companies across the nation have a massive $13 million in uncollected bills because of the average household. They just can't afford to pay. I mean, it's getting very difficult out there. Yet the power companies show no sign of lowering prices, as one would expect. And that's why I'm lowering my energy bills, thanks to today's sponsor, E-Saver Watt. That's E-Saver Watt. And absolutely love the cost savings it brings to me. And thanks to E-Saver Watt, I'm able to slash my power bills, beat the utility companies, and keep more money in my pocket every month, which I like. The E-Saver Watt plugs into any wall outlet. And I would suggest getting three, maybe two, three, especially depending on the size of the house you have. But it does work, and it does, well, by plugging this device into your wall outlet, it helps stop a home from wasting unnecessary energy. It does protect your appliances. It reduces a home's electricity usage. And as I said, it extends the lifespan of appliances, protecting them from power surges and such. So it does ensure a very consistent and safe flow of electricity throughout the home and much more. The cost of savings in the first month alone that you're going to find had the E-Saver Watt paying for itself. So please visit don'twastepower.com. That's don'twastepower.com. Or simply click the link in the description below to get the nation's leading way to lower energy bills, up to 66% off, free express shipping, plus several other bonuses with every order, completely for free. That's don'twastepower.com, don'twastepower.com. And I'm going to thank them for helping sponsor this program. Again, with me, folks, is author Jack Cashel. I'm so glad to have met Jack, and from his books, TWA 800, and many, so many others, folks. Look him up, follow him on Amazon, but by all means, you've got to get his latest book, and here it is right here. Ashley, okay, the untold story of the women of January 6th. I don't know why I can't remember that subtitle, but I've got to tell you, it's much more than that. It's that and much more, I should say. So with me again is Jack Cashel. And Jack, continuing with your thought, I apologize for the interruption. But
oh, no, that's okay. Yeah, we were talking about Dr. Roger Mitchell.
Yes.
The medical examiner of the District of Columbia, who was very influential in the railroading of Derek Chauvin. And he had, he called the, as I was saying, he threatened, coerced the medical examiner of Hennepin County, Minnesota, to alter the autopsy report for George Floyd to implicate Chauvin and his colleagues as murderers. Because in fact, Floyd died of a massive heart attack. He could have been shoveling snow. I mean, he had a severely damaged heart, and he was the methamphetamines in his system aggravated it. The fentanyl didn't help either, but that was not really the cause. And he was under tremendous stress. He was resisting arrest, you know, and this big guy. And there's nothing the cops could have done. He was dying. He was dying before they put him on the ground. He was a dead, you know, he was going to be dead. There were lots of other causes, the delay in the medical, in the EMT arriving, et cetera, but that, not to go into the details there. But what one of the things that Mitchell did during that trial, and the trial is now taking place in April 2021, he's out of the office now. He's moved on to Howard University, where he's chief pathologist. From that position, he reaches out during the trial, while the trial is still going on, after Dr. David Fowler, who had been Maryland's chief medical examiner for 17 years, testified on Chauvin's behalf, Mitchell reaches out to the Attorney General of Maryland and demands that he launch an investigation into Fowler's track record while he was in Maryland's medical examiner. And he does. The Attorney General obliges Mitchell by doing that. This is going on during the trial. So all other potential witnesses for Chauvin going forward know that there is a price to pay if you dare tell the truth about what happened that day. And this is the guy Mitchell, who I believe was still, certainly his office was now in control of the, you know, the reports that are going to come out on Roseanne Boylan and on Brian Sicknick, and they could do what they want. And what they did in both of them was to delay the reports as long as possible because they did not want these stories out there.
And that, okay, you mentioned Brian, Officer Brian Sicknick. That's like the cause celeb of January 6th. And you put to rest in your book, I mean, you address many aspects of that. You want to address the Brian Sicknick situation as it really is or really was?
Yeah, because we mentioned that in a previous episode, but it bears repeating because it is the critical detail in this whole case. And it's the Sicknick, as we know, as first of all, I should say that I learned from one of the women I interviewed, Sarah Carpenter, an NYPD officer, former, on her way back to New York, she calls a friend in Maryland and says, hey, you know, blah, 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 blah. And she says, yeah, I was at the Capitol today, not thinking anything of it. And then the woman on the phone says to Sarah, you killed him. You killed an officer with a fire extinguisher. And by you, she meant the protesters in general. And Sarah was really upset. She didn't want to be part of a murderous, lethal riot. That wasn't what she had gone to Washington for. And this woman's husband was a retired Capitol police officer. So he obviously had inside information. This means that on the night of January 6th, Doug, the rumor was already afoot that a police officer had been killed by a protester using a fire extinguisher. That did not happen. No one was killed that day. No police officer was killed that day. Brian Sicknick was captured on video later walking around, you know, healthy at the end of the day. On January 7th, just coincidentally, and I believe it's a coincidence, I don't believe there was foul play here, Brian Sicknick dies of a stroke, you know, a series of strokes. And on January 8th, according to two law enforcement officials who talked to the New York Times, Sicknick was killed when a Capitol protester hit him over the head with a fire extinguisher. He was rushed out of the building with a bloody gash. This is the detail that New York Times is using, taken to the hospital where he died. So what they did, what someone did, and this is where I use the phrase Jacobins, because who knows who exactly made this decision, but someone made the conscious decision to turn Sicknick's death of natural causes into a murder. And that so tainted everything that happened on January 6th that those who defended the protesters originally backed off. You know, their whatever defenders they had in the media or in the Congress, backed away. Because then they became aiders and abettors of a murderous mob, right?
Yeah, and no one wants to be, no rational, sane person wants to be associated with that. But in reality, Brian Sicknick had, I don't know if you would call it genetic, but defects at the base of his brain, not anywhere else that happened to give way on that particular day. And I'm no stranger to that kind of death. Okay, I've seen that in my life where people have aneurysms or sometimes capillary telangiectasions, if I pronounce that correctly, that just break, give way. You know, it could be, you could be walking down the street, you could be doing whatever. So that seems to be the case, as opposed to the official narrative of, hey, you know, they killed Brian Sicknick. But go ahead, sir.
And I will say this, is that whoever did the autopsy wasn't in on a game plan, because they did the autopsy in the D.C. medical examiner's office, did it on January 8th. So they knew as of January 8th how he died, right? And it's, I mean, you could finesse some autopsy reports, but you're not going to finesse a stroke into being hit over the head with a fire extinguisher. That's a career killer, whoever does that. What they could do, though, is their only recourse was to sit on the autopsy report. They weren't going to release it at all until Judicial Watch sued them and forced them to come public with it. And that was more than 100 days after the death. So for 100 days, the media had free rein, and the Democrats had free rein. They have this ceremony for Sicknick in the rotunda of the Capitol. They bury him in Arlington. He's in the hero, blah, blah, blah. And then they start getting ghoulish. You know, there's a series of suicides that take place afterwards, four of them, among Capitol Police officers, all men. And they start attributing them to the Capitol, to the insurrection, right? Mm-hmm. The word of the day. And so by the time they're finished, now they have five people who died. And they use that phrase all the time. Merrick Garland uses it, Biden uses it, five people killed, you know. And they're not referring to the protesters. They're talking about the police officers, because they make the assumption somehow that the trauma they suffered on January 6th caused them all to commit suicide. Now, if you were a reporter for a legitimate newspaper, like, say, the New York Times, wouldn't you want to go out and find out what these guys had in common? What was the common thread? Why did they commit suicide?
One would think.
But no, they haven't.
Yeah.
They just want to lump them into the body count.
Well, as you write, as to Sicknick having served his purpose for those 100 days, the House committee abandoned him. The report mentioned him once, and then just to thank his family. It's really disgusting, the behavior, the intent of the Jacobin justice warriors, I suppose I would call them. It's disgusting to see how they use people in death and in life. This is just, and then of course the people who were incarcerated ostensibly because of the treatment against the
I think you're exactly right, Doug. I think the single most grotesque distortion that took place in that whole sequence, this sea of lies, is the conscious decision to kill Brian Sicknick, to have him murdered,
yeah.
Right? Someone had to make that decision. They had the rumor, and that rumor was good. It was serving a purpose. And now, well, gosh, we've got a body. We could tie the body to the rumor. If I were Sicknick's family, I'd be beside myself now. I haven't contacted them. I don't want to. You lose your loved one. I don't want to mess with that. But I hope someone who knows them gets to them. Sicknick was apparently a good guy, Trump supporter. You know, I'm a veteran Air National Guard. You know, he and Ashley Babbitt may have even crossed paths. But to use his death the way they did, this is right out of a horror movie.
Yes. And thank you for that. You know, Yeah. I guess that says it all. To use a person in death like that, that's just unconscionable. And of course, look where we are today, okay, with respect to all of these unconscionable acts by these Jacobin justice warriors. And I love that phrase too, by the way, as you weave it through the book. I don't want to hamstring. I can't believe how quickly time is going.
Yeah, I just checked the lock. I said we already went through an hour. I seem like 15 minutes.
Yeah, seriously. So we have about 20 minutes left. So you go wherever you want to go because, man, I'm telling you what, folks, this is one of the greatest books I've read. Go ahead, sir.
You know, it's interesting, Doug. I was thinking about this. Are you familiar with the book and the movie Operation Mincemeat?
You know, I've heard of it and not yet, but I will be.
And what happens is this, is they want, the British want to give the Germans the impression that they're planning some operation that they're not, right? So what they do is they take a dead British person, right? And they dress him up in a uniform and they drop him offshore in Spain, have him wash up with these secret maps and stuff on, right?
Ah, yes.
And they were all wrestling with their consciences because it seems so ghoulish, right? Mm. To take a dead body, even though for a much larger and grander cause, and to basically to blaspheme, you know, by making believe that he was someone else and that he was serving some other purpose. Well, in Sicknick's case, it's even worse. That's because they're using it for a terrible cause, a bad cause, the cause of destroying democracy, not saving democracy. And as a final note, I would say, you know, what I've tried to do, and part of the reason why I wove these stories of these women through is because I like books with heroes and good people. You know, I just don't want to recite facts and bad things happen, blah, blah, blah. I like to see justice prevail. And what I found very encouraging about these women, and they virtually all of them had kind of rough backgrounds. You know, they had a lot of speed bumps in their lives. But that just ordinary, independent, flyover country women had come to a recognition of the state of affairs that eluded certainly their wishy-washy, suburban, quasi-GOP female counterparts, let alone, you know, the females who run the Democratic Party, who are the single greatest threat to democracy in the world today, are educated liberal female friends, the ELFs in my acronym world, how they prevail, why they came, the distances they came, the struggles they make. And once they get there, you know, and they go through this incredible ordeal after the fact, and yet not one of the eight women I've talked to regretted their decision to go to Washington on January 6th. Not one of them, you know, took that easy route out and saying, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, Donald Trump made me do this. I was a fool. Please have mercy on me. None of them did that. And that is a testament to their courage and their conviction. And they're the backbone of our country, and the men as well. And I asked this one woman who was beaten very severely, Victoria White. In fact, her beating, Julie Kelly called it the worst since the civil rights era, you know, by police. I would say it is the most grotesque beating of a female I've ever seen captured on video. And she was beaten in a tunnel by a very specific individual who's named in a lawsuit, Bagshaw, who's Metropolitan Police. But I asked her, I said, why do you think they treated the women so badly? The men got it worse in court. They were sentenced to longer sentences for the same crimes.
Right.
But the women got it worse on the steps of the Capitol. One older woman, I saw the video, and she's never been identified. She's probably in her 70s. She's just standing there. She's got a Trump flag on the back as a cape. And a police officer comes up, just pushes her down these concrete steps. She goes back first, you know?
Yeah, I saw that video. Yes.
I said to Victoria, why do you think they treated women so badly? And she said, it was interesting. She said, I think they were trying to rile up the men. right? And that's what happened. The one guy who comes to Victoria's defense is now serving 87 months in prison. They had succeeded in several cases. And they did that throughout. I mean, they provoked the crowd. And you've seen enough video, Doug, to know that it was reckless, amateurish, unprofessional. And it's hard to know where the conspiracy ends and the incompetence begins, because they flow together, you know, like the Epstein jailers. You know, you know enough about government run entities to know that, yes, they could conceivably have been that bad. So it always lets the conspirators have a plausible excuse for getting out of a jam that they put themselves into.
And to your point, and this is not about me, but I can attest to that. Look, I've been inside Attica to interview prisoners. I've been inside Rikers during my career as an investigator. I got to tell you something, okay? The level of incompetence is evident, but I have to also say that in some cases, the guards scared me more than the people in chains behind the bars. I'm telling you, it's just it's not what people would think. You know, so you're correct. I mean, there is a conspiracy, but there's also a level of incompetence, and dare I say, well, who cares? I mean, it's this treating human life as really nothing. It's indescribable to me. You could do it as an author the way you write, but man, so you're correct. I mean, incompetence and conspiracy, yes, I agree 100%. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, one thing that is not enough time to talk about in this segment, but the thing that I lead to towards the end of the book, and I got there reluctantly because I tend to be, I hate to say this, no one's going to believe this, sort of an anti-conspiracy theorist. You know, you got to prove it to me to know there's a conspiracy. You can't just throw a few random facts together and say, oh, it's a conspiracy, as people are wont to do sometimes. But it was an inside job.
Yes.
And there is in the final chapter, it's the penultimate chapter, the next last chapter, which I titled John Doe Number 3. And this is something some people are like, I've talked to younger people and they don't even know what I'm talking about. Doug understands, of course, but the giveaway is the confluence of three events all taking place at 1 o'clock. And that was the initial breach by Ray Epps and his crew, the finding of the pipe bombs, you know. And the presence, a bizarre presence and concealment of her presence of Kamala Harris at the DNC. These things show, A, that the planning was not synchronized quite as well as it might have been, but B, that there is no denying that they knew that what we were being told, I mean, by they, I mean Biden and Kamala Harris, was false, and that there was something they were covering up. And that covering up was the alleged pipe bomber.
Man, would you please write a book about that? about the January 6th pipe bomber. I know Duran Beatty from Revolver has done a lot of great investigative reporting. Julie Kelly as well. But man, I'll tell you what, get you on that. Oh, boy.
Well, you know, and what I have, I would say if I have anything over those guys, as I'm older, I have a little historical knowledge here. And the John Doe number 3 refers back to the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995.
Right.
And which I've covered pretty extensively. And what happens is that Timothy McVeigh goes to Oklahoma City with an accomplice. About 30 different people see the accomplice. They talk to the FBI. The FBI reports at an evidentiary hearing after McVeigh had been caught that, yes, multiple eyewitnesses had seen McVeigh with this other fellow. They all described him the same way, short, stocky, swarthy. The FBI puts out like an all-points bulletin for John Doe number two, McVeigh being John Doe number one, and the other guy being John Doe number two. Nationwide manhunt. Big rewards, right? And then they kind of lose interest, and John Doe number two just fades to the end of the battle. And the same thing happens here. We have this $500,000 reward, big manhunt for the pipe bomber, and they're just going to fade away. Because I think in both cases, someone realized that this person is not someone who should be caught, right?
Exactly. Yes.
And meaning in the case of Oklahoma City, there were two possibilities. One, the most likely, is that he was a confidential human source for the FBI. And the other possibility being that he was a Muslim co-conspirator. In both cases, they destroy the narrative. That the right wing, you know, it breaks the Reichstag fire narrative that that the Clinton administration used artfully. You know, he saved his presidency at Oklahoma City. He's such a good handholder, something Biden is not.
Oh yeah, the
blamed it on Newt Gingrich, blamed it on Rush Limbaugh and the Republican Revolution, all that. And then January 6th, we have the pipe bomber. And initially, they blame it all on the. Oh, my God, think how bad it would have been if the pipe bombs had gone off, if we hadn't found the pipe bombs, you know, and the heroes are the people finding the pipe bombs. And then they realize that, hold it, Kamala Harris is at DNC. The police have done, the Secret Service have done a sweep of the exterior with their dogs, and there's no bomb, right? and that's another episode, though.
I got to ask you real quick. What in the hell was she doing at the DNC?
And this is where they convict themselves for a year. I mean, they've never talked about it, right? For a year afterwards, no one even knew about it,
right?
And so, imagine, given her penchant for drama, she should have been out there the next day saying, "I was just feet away from being blown up by these radical." MAGA rioters with their pipe bombs, right? But she's never talked about it. Biden has never talked about it, right? And it was a year before the media even knew she was at the DNC. And what that meant is that a lot of the cases that had already been tried, and part of the evidence against the J6er was that when they were in the Capitol, Kamala Harris was in the Capitol. She wasn't. She was at the DNC, and then they whisked her away from the DNC in some undisclosed cave somewhere. I don't know. That is the giveaway, and that story is still evolving, as I mentioned in the book. And hats off to Darren Beatty and to Representative Massey and Julie Kelly, et cetera, the people who did all the spade work on that. Dan Bongino's all over that, too. And as a Secret Service guy, he has a particular knowledge about how that proceeded. But it is an eye opener.
Wow, I've got to say, and folks, man, Jack has really encapsulated so many events, things happening today, but things that created the narrative of January 6th, and with specific, in a sense, specific focus on the women of January 6th, but it's much deeper, much broader than that. In his book, Ashley. Folks, get a copy, get it today. Make this a number one bestseller. In fact, get a couple and make sure your local lawmaker has or your representative has a copy of this, because this is a valuable investigative instrument, I believe, that could unravel really the narrative of January 6th. Ashley, The Untold Story of Women of January 6th, it's available right now. And in fact, it came out on May 14th. And I was so proud to be able to be one of the first to interview Jack about this and to continue this, because this is a story that keeps on giving. Jack, we've got about 5 minutes left. So you have the floor for the close on this, because there's so much. I mean, there's so many angles we could approach this from. And you do a masterful job.
Let me give credit to Doug, yourself, and people who do what you do. Because, you know, when I, in my book Unmasking Obama, I talked about this, you know, because I like to write positive stories and I want to write an Obama book that's positive. How can you do that? It's because I want to talk about the people who break the news. And the people who break the news now in America are what I call the samizdat, but from the Russian term of the underground reporting. Nothing breaks from the New York Times, Washington Post are ridiculous. All the stories that matter come up from underneath, from citizen journalists, from podcasters amplifying the message. And then finally it reaches another level. And then, you know, maybe it ends up on Fox News. It's not going to end up on the other side. But you're right. It's there is a network of people like us who are doing all the heavy lifting now. And but it takes a while for it to percolate. So what you're helping, like tweeting, just say to your audience, if you tweet this out or share it with your friends, it'll make a big difference because we have to. There are the people in Congress have to know about this. President Trump has to know about this. There is the elements. I'm shocked just that they don't talk about the fact that he started an hour late and his people weren't at the riot. You know, his people were still back on the Ellipse listening to him talk about walking patriotically and peacefully to the Capitol. Right. So there's a lot of evidence out there that on our side, we have to know. Your congressman has to know. Your senator has to know. You know, your governor has to know because they have to defend what happened on January 6th. They have to defend those people.
In the remaining 2 minutes we have, do you believe that the majority of people will awaken to the truth? Given, I mean, now, I know they're starting to awaken, especially when everything is so in your face right now. But do you believe that enough people will awaken to make the difference so we don't have blood flowing in the streets from a civil war? Because no one wants that.
Yeah, I think they will, Doug. I think you're right. And I think that's the alternative, is that if we don't wake up now, you know, and if 2024 goes like 2020, it could be really pretty dicey afterwards, you know? But I think it's the, I think we have this opportunity in the next 4 or 5 months to alert enough people to, and it's a big education for people because they don't know any of this stuff, you know? But we have to at least alert the people on our side because they're educable. The people who were, you know, I don't know about January 6th. I do know this is that when I first put notice of the book on my Facebook page, I had a hugely positive response. That would not have been true 2 years ago. 2 years ago, I would have gotten, Jack, you know, what are you doing? You know this from your own audience.
Oh, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The tide has turned. It is not totally turned, but it is turning. And the way the Samizdat works is for every person in your audience is his own publisher or her own publisher. They can take your information and spread it and distribute it. And that is the way we get the truth out today. We're not going to get it by... We don't even have a Rush Limbaugh anymore, you know? We don't have a unifying force on our side. We've got to push it from the ground up.
Boy, you're 100% accurate. Oh, man, I'll tell you what. What a great expose. Jack Cashel, of course, writing his latest book, a book that folks that you've got to get your hands on. And seriously, I ordered two. And I'm going to be ordering more because this is such an important work. I believe, and when Jack said, you know, he's not prone to conspiracy theories without the proof, I'm telling you right now, he delivers the proof, the information in this book, Ashley, The Untold Story of the Women of January 6th. Again, it's a work of, it's really a masterpiece. I can't say enough good about it, but I will say that it's an investigative report that to me is so important to show what really happened and really expose the Jacobin justice that we're seeing today, we're experiencing today, and we will continue to experience unless enough people awaken to the plot. And Jack does his level best to and phenomenal work to expose that. Jack Cashel, thank you so very much for spending such a long time with me. I appreciate it.
I'll be in your neighbor in a few weeks, Doug. I'll stop by and we'll talk some more.
Yeah, I love it, brother. I love it. I can't wait. Jack Cashel, folks. Thank you, Jack. Appreciate you.
Bye-bye. Right.
Folks, that'll do it. I want you to all have a great weekend. And seriously.